I'm Anna Lutfi and this is The Verdict. It's brought to you by the Dixon Poon School of Law, King's College London, and it's a radical experiment in legal podcasting. We bring the law closer to the public in a world where legislation, regulation and the courts seem increasingly remote. Last week I spoke with Frederick Moster, Professor of Practice at the Dixon Poon School of Law. This week, he joins his colleagues at the Equitas Project, Professor Martin Senthleben, who is Professor of Intellectual Property Law and Director of the Institute for Information Law at the University of Amsterdam, and also Professor Marketa Trimble, who is the Samuel S. Lionel Professor of Intellectual Property Law at the William S. Boyd School of Law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And we're also joined by Professor Eleonora Rosati, who is full professor of intellectual property law, director of the Institute for Intellectual Property and Market Law at Stockholm University, as well as the associate of the Centre for Intellectual Property and Information Law at the University of Cambridge. Together, these highly distinguished experts are working in close collaboration internationally to create new legal digital human rights principles that we can use across the world to regulate the online domain. The team explained to The Verdict some of the challenges that we face in finding the right regulatory balance between freedom on the one hand and regulation of digital content on the other. First of all, thank you so much, all of you, for joining me. And I think we'll just start with a sort of springboard question about intellectual property law, which you are all experts in from one perspective or another. And I'm just wondering if each of you could take a little time to tell me your personal relationship with these new disciplines that are springing up, namely cyber law and digital rights, and how you see these two fields connected to intellectual property law. I don't know, Frederick, if you want to start the ball rolling.
Okay, I'll give you a brief. My experience started when we had the cyber squatting issues some time ago, and I was dragged into it kicking and screaming. And at the time, the US Commerce Department and the World Intellectual Property Organization called a panel together to look at the whole issue, and in particular to try and deal with domain names and cyber squatting. So that was my first foray into the area, and I enjoyed it so much that I stayed in that area and took an interest in the beginnings of then cyber law, and obviously it's just remained with me. And as time passed by and I wasn't dealing with these issues in the trenches, it became very apparent relatively early on that the entire practice of intellectual property law changed diametrically from purely real world issues into online issues and digital issues. And that was my foray into this area.
Professor Rosati.
Thank you. But now that you make me think about this, I would say that my very first encounter with IP law was from a digital perspective. I have to say that I didn't study intellectual property formally at the beginning. There were no courses at my university on IP. So I started studying it on my own, having read an article in a newspaper on the challenges that the internet would be posing to copyright. So for me, it was really a close relationship since the very beginning, and I immediately felt attracted to copyright and IP, and the rest is an experience that I've continued developing in this field, in which indeed digital, online and copyright have always been very close. I'm not saying friends, but certainly acquaintances.
It's interesting that Professor Moster, you mentioned the transition from real world to online, which begs the question of whether the online is real and in what sense it is real and material. And then Professor Rosati, you talked about copyright, which of course has a long history in the real world. Would you say, Professor Senthleben, that once things are transferred to the digital or the virtual arena, things that had a form and an understanding or a set of properties in the so-called real world start to change in unpredictable ways?
Well, as I see it, it's perhaps not so much that things really change. It's really the transformation to the digital environment where, as we could say, access to knowledge and access to resources that very often enjoy protection under copyright law, trademark law, whatever field of intellectual property, become really much more important for personal development. So the moment society becomes more digital, the moment intellectual property is also embedded in a broader framework of fundamental rights. And this, to make a connection with your question of how we all explored questions of internet and intellectual property, this is very much a central element of my personal approach. When I started my studies of intellectual property at the Institute for Information Law, it was from the very beginning this particular tension between, on the one hand, protection of these assets under intellectual property rights, and on the other hand, access to information and the fundamental rights like freedom of expression, freedom of the arts, of science, and so on, that form counterbalances. And I think we still are not at the end of the discussion of how to reconcile these different rights and find an appropriate balance yet.
Thank you. Well, we will come back, I think, to the perennial question of how to limit and delimit freedom of expression. But if I may turn to Professor Trimble, who I understand has done research into what you call the territorial nature of national laws compared with the borderlessness of cyber law. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, about how we can understand cyber law as a borderlessness and the need for certain kinds of extranational solutions to the problems that cyber law generates.
Thank you. Yes, so my journey to cyber law and to issues that concern the internet started with my interest and research in intellectual property law and the intersection of IP law and private international law or conflict of laws. One would think that naturally this intersection implies issues on the internet, right? Today, we think surely if there are cross-border issues in any area of law, it must transpire on the internet. But in fact, there used to be a body of scholarship about IP law and conflict of laws that was completely divorced from the internet, that evolved before the internet emerged. So through my interest in conflict of laws and IP law, I came to appreciate the problems that arise on the internet and the cyber law issues. Frankly, I, for a long time, resisted the idea that there is cyber law. I insisted that cyber law was not a separate area of law, that cyber law was an industry perspective on specific issues in various areas of law, but really resisted the idea that cyber law is a separate area of law. But it is. It is, and it is more than just an industry perspective. One thing that's really key to understanding the various problems that transpire on the internet is that the internet, by its design and by default, is borderless. Somebody who posts content on the internet in one country, unless they act in some way or unless a country acts in a certain way, that content will be available all over the world, or at least in all places where access to the internet exists. Now, this is not completely accurate. It's only the default position. Of course, we have seen the development of geo-blocking technologies. We have seen countries who block access to content from their territories. So on the one hand, we have the default design of borderlessness, but on the other hand, we also have ever-improving technologies that allow internet actors to limit the reach of content on the internet, and that also permit, for better or worse, countries to limit access to the internet or to certain content on the internet from their territories.
Is that what you mean by geo-blocking? I'm glad you raised it.
Yes, so
just to block access.
Right. So when I talk in my research and in what I do about geo-blocking, it is the type of blocking that means that internet actor alone, let's say a website or a social media provider, blocks certain content on its own, or if a country, for instance, decide to block access. There is another type of blocking, which might be blocking through an internet intermediary, let's say an internet service provider, who might have the capacity to block certain content, let's say content generated by a user, by a third party. And that's yet another type of blocking.
Professor Rosati, there was a recent judgment at the Court of Justice of the European Union, I believe on the 22nd of June, where it was concluded that online, or held that online platforms are not responsible for content illegally posted. And that gave third parties that Professor Trimble has just been talking about legal exemptions from those responsibilities. How do you see that judgment in terms of a general trend, and what concerns does it raise?
Thank you for this question, Anna. I would say that there have been many different angles on this recent and very important decision. And I will not be inclined to say that the Court of Justice has ruled out liability in each and every context for these types of internet actors. So I will say that the picture that the court has painted is one of great complexity. And this complexity now is transferred on national courts, which have to apply this ruling. But having said that, and leaving aside the details of this judgment, I personally see a growing trend towards responsabilization of internet actors. And this has been happening at the level of case law, but also at the level of policy initiatives and legislation. So Marchetta earlier on was speaking about one additional type of blocking, that is blocking by intermediaries. And of course, here a related issue is that of website blocking orders, which are now increasingly being granted by courts around the world, and even countries that were reluctant to recognize this type of remedy now have courts that have issued orders in this sense. So we are seeing an innovation on the level of case law, with orders of different types being granted. So we are going towards an age where static blocking is really not the most frequent type of application that is made, and we have instead dynamic or even live website blocking orders. So creativity on the side of courts. And then at the policy and legislative level, in Europe, we are seeing initiatives being presented in different fields. In relation to copyright, the judgment of the Court of Justice that you refer to is to be framed within a changing ecosystem. In fact, there is a new directive that was adopted by the European Union in 2019, and which member states had to transpose into their own laws by the 7th of June. But the truth is that only few of them have finished this process or are approaching completion, which contains a provision, Article 17, among other things, which change things a bit, because it posits that certain types of internet actors, which the directive refers to as online content sharing service providers, do perform acts restricted by copyright, and as a result, they are required to obtain an authorization that will cover their activities and the activities of users of their services. But that is not all, because still in the EU, we are seeing a very complex and important discussion taking place in relation to recent proposals from the European Commission. Here I'm thinking about the Digital Markets Act, the Digital Service Act, and in particular the latter confirms the idea that at certain conditions internet actors should be exempted from liability, but at the same time introduces clarifications or new obligations for these subjects. So overall, the trend that we are seeing is one of enhanced responsibility, and discussions similar to those that we are seeing in Europe are also happening elsewhere. And here, for instance, the reference can be made to the situation of press publishers vis-a-vis online news aggregators. We have had legislation in Europe, but now we are seeing a discussion taking place also in other jurisdictions, including most notably Australia. The discussion around a topic similar to those covered by Article 17 has been raised also in the United States. So it is a global discourse, and the trend that I'm seeing is one of reconsideration of the type of immunities enjoyed by internet actors. And in all these, of course, also the attempt to make sure that the ecosystem is a fair and balanced one.
That's a perfect segue into the next part of our discussion, actually, which looks, I mean, you've given us a really nice succinct overview of the transition from a sort of static blocking framework to a more dynamic blocking, which involves transnational actors speaking to one another as to how to create responsibilities online and entrench them. And nonetheless, and I'm going to throw this at Professors Mostert and Sempleben, we see huge problems arising from illegally unmonitored, unregulated activity regarding crimes much more egregious than say copyright, including the trafficking of human beings and online harms, content, such as child abuse content. So obviously these kinds of criminal behaviors need immediate and urgent attention. But then we are faced with this problem that if we overblock in order to regulate such conduct, we find ourselves perhaps in breach of fundamental human rights, such as freedom of expression. Would either of you two like to address that rather challenging issue in whatever way you feel comfortable?
Well, could I suggest this? I'll start off with the underblocking, and Martin is an expert on overblocking. If that sounds good to you, Martin.
That's perfectly fine, yes.
So on the underblocking aspects, these are things that greatly concern society as a whole and on a global and international basis, which is obviously the real important example, which is enshrined in the current draft of the online UK Online Safety Bill, which is child sexual abuse online. And in so many other parts of the world, there's an incredibly well-documented study done by the New York Times, which deals with the statistics on this. But for instance, it grew online images from 1 million per annum to 45 million per annum in a space of less than 8 years. And it's just growing exponentially. So that's an example of where there obviously is underblocking, as there is with human trafficking, as the United Nations report recently pointed out. So you have those type of typical serious egregious crimes, including the human trafficking, but then in today's pandemic and closer to intellectual property, counterfeits of, believe it or not, I only saw this a few days ago, but now we have COVID passports or COVID certificates for those who want to travel that are being counterfeited. But before that, more seriously, vaccines have been counterfeited, and before that, PPE. So things that are of great public interest and health interest have been counterfeited. So you have those type of crimes that deal with the serious issues in society that are totally underblocked and is of great concern because of the algorithmic robotic processes that the platforms install. And that very same issue on the other end of the spectrum is to deal with the overblocking of freedom of expression, of user-generated content by musicians, by authors, by so many individuals, which Martin can very eloquently speak to.
Professor Sempleben.
Yeah, thanks so much. Well, actually, it is something which Professor Rosati has also introduced already. I would say, considering the new copyright legislation, for instance, that is now about to be implemented or has already been implemented in several member states, we can say there is truly a climate change. So in the past, the default position was that we trust citizens of democratic societies, and we say everybody enjoys the freedom of uploading content that he would like to share with others on the internet, and we control for copyright infringement, also trademark infringement, only after this has appeared on the internet. So actually it was freedom to make contributions to the public space that has been created by the internet as a medium. And well, what we see now is a shift in the sense that we no longer trust our citizens. I mean, what is happening with these blocking technologies, these filtering technologies, is that basically every upload that comes from a user is suspicious. And the lawmaker in the field of copyright now is saying to online platforms, well, you no longer enjoy freedom in the sense of a liability privilege that allows you to first let appear whatever users want to upload on the internet. Instead, you have to control and to check what is uploaded. And only if the mechanism of filtering gives you indications that there is no infringement, then it can appear on the internet. And of course, as these filtering mechanisms are not very sophisticated, even though lots and lots of money has already been invested, at least this is what industry specialists are telling us, even though all this investment has already been made, the filters are not clever enough to make really a reliable distinction between piracy, legitimately should be filtered out, and parody, pastiche, memes, mashups, and so on, that contribute importantly to the democratic discourse in the online space. And this is something that I find really worrisome. Also, I would say the whole process has been quite fast. It is really a paradigm shift, and it has taken only a couple of years to move from a position of trust to a position of every upload is suspicious. And at least with regards to content that is very close to freedom of expression, which in particular in the area of copyrighted content is self-evident, I'm quite surprised to which extent we have been willing as a society to give up the freedom that was traditionally enjoyed. But just to be 100% sure, I'm saying this against the background of the copyright debate. I'm not saying that in other areas, as Frederick has described, other measures of preventing harmful content to arrive at the internet would be totally justified. So what I'm saying is really something of concern with regard to the copyright arena.
Thank you. That's very helpful because it pushes us forward on our discussion about the need for standardized international regulatory procedures, which I'm taking from all of your contributions that you all share this in common, a recognition that this is a matter of some urgency. Would any of you like to comment before we wrap up the first part of this discussion?
Well, Anna, if I may, Marketa here. Yes, I do believe that there is really an urgency to tackle some of these issues internationally, certainly, particularly those issues that Frederick mentioned. At the same time, I think it's important to realize that there is a certain limit to countries' ability to agree on certain things. Just think about the matters that Martin referred to, the freedom of expression and, let's say, protection of minors from certain type of content. Even within the European Union, which is pretty cohesive in terms of its values, it's often difficult, for instance, to agree on ratings of motion pictures because countries have very different views of the protection need to protect minors from certain type of content. So when you think about this globally, the problem becomes even bigger, of course, and we can imagine how it will be difficult to bring on the same page countries as different as, let's say, China, Iran, the United States, and members of the European Union. So at the same time, we should also recognize that many of these solutions cannot be purely national or international, and that we are dealing now with extranational forces. We are dealing with corporations that are either multinational, or they might not be multinational, but their scope of activities, because of the internet, is de facto global. And for those types of players, we might need to think about rules that will span the entire globe, that will be truly extranational. And so I would suggest that where our efforts have been centered was not as much creating a national instrument or international instrument, but really to focus on the global perspective and the perspective that encompasses various types of players, entities, including these intermediaries that actually operate on the global stage and at the global level.
Thank you. Well, we will come back to that in the second part of our discussion, where we look at the Equitas project that you are all involved with one way or the other, and the notion of a digital Magna Carta, and whether such a notion is feasible or perhaps too idealistic, as Professor Trimble, you were suggesting, but potentially there are difficulties with what countries can agree on ultimately. But we'll turn to that, and we will open up part two of our discussion with an introduction to the Equitas project, which all of you are involved with, and which is a very exciting cutting-edge project, which I hope we can dig into a little bit more deeply in the course of this second part. Professor Mostert, do you want to start the ball rolling as to what Equitas is and how it started and how you became involved?
Yes, I'd be very happy to. So I think where it all started, as you just said, actually, the key word is informal. We were all shooting the breeze and talking about these issues, which very interestingly, I think we all look at the same jigsaw puzzle. We come from it from slightly different angles, and we all started seeing that there's something common here, which is of great concern to us all. And as Marketa has said so eloquently, is truly global in nature. And how do you deal with these issues of, for instance, underblocking and overblocking? And so we started saying, well, why don't we develop something called the principles? There are other principles out there, but specifically in our area and with our experience. And I think it's on that very informal basis where it started. And it was really to try and form this, as it were, baseline of basic principles common to humanity around the world on a global basis, but as Marketa said, to deal with those issues which transcend just local or regional areas, which we can try and kind of demarcate and help develop principles in common. Because the fact is, the internet's global, it isn't local, with a few exceptions.
Would anyone else like to jump in terms of how they see the project in relation to what Professor Mostert has just said?
Well, I think it's important to point out where we come from. I mean, the principles, when you read the general opening, the first clauses and so on, this is very much grounded in, first of all, the belief that the internet offers an unprecedented open space for conversations, for exchange of opinions, a market square for ideas. At the same time, it is very important to make sure that fundamental rights are observed in this environment, not only by governments, but by the private actors who take over very often leading and crucial roles in this environment. So I think it's an important step to realize that what the principles propose to some extent is providing a framework for an approach that is balanced and preserves fundamental rights, even if in the online space we are not confronted with the actions of states and public bodies.
So I think we can agree that Equitas is a vision on some level, but it's also quite a practical project, because it brings together experts like yourself who see the urgency for regulating the internet, creating international regulatory procedures that can be upheld, even though we've also talked about the need to recognise the limits on such principles. But they have to be there, one, because content has to be regulated, and two, because people's freedoms have to be upheld. So we're talking about a vision, but we're also talking about material principles. And Equitas does have material principles, does it not? That you've actually been instrumental as a group in drafting those principles. Would anyone like to perhaps give an overview on how that process evolved, where you actually could put on to paper or to screen, if you like, concrete principles for a future digital Magna Carta?
There is the saying that if you have 20 lawyers in the room, you have 40 opinions. But if you have 22 law professors in the room, I think you have 160 opinions. So it was quite something to get everyone on board. But what we did in essence was we tried really hard to build consensus and build this not only for that purpose, which in itself is really important, but from a global perspective so that we all had an input. So we are on the call, and Anna Holmberg-Borkman, we developed the first set and worked really hard at trying to do that, and then obviously circulated it amongst the group to develop this as to where you see it now. So it was really very much, I'm extremely happy to say, very much despite the joke, a combined effort and a joint effort to get where we are, because it was so interesting in the drafting process to see the different aspects come together from people's not only geographical perspective and their local law, legal system perspective, but to see all the ideas come together as a whole, which was in the end, you know, I would like to think very rewarding.
Equitas principles include the absence of due process as a problem and the need for due process online, procedural fairness, need for natural justice. Do we see a realistic approach being possible in the future where concrete legal tests can be drafted and implemented in a court-like or a court-simulated environment for the future, bringing online platforms and service providers to holding them to account? Does the ACTAS project actually have the potential to morph into not only a founding document, but perhaps also a set of online regulatory spaces and procedures? And what sorts of legal tests might we be looking at to regulate what kinds of behavior? Would anyone like to speak to that very general question?
I think in a nutshell, I think one way of looking at it, Anna, is to think of it as an infrastructure, an architecture for the legal system to some extent of dealing with these new issues in the online environment, where essentially the volume velocity of content is so fast and you can't run to court and then quickly try and get the right judgment. There's just too much volume. And in many cases, by the time you run to court, it's all over by the shouting. So the idea here is to take principles which have been around, but to modify them and to adapt them to the online world. And certainly the infrastructure, the architecture here is the analogy with the railroads in the late 1800s, essentially was in the interest of the progress of society that was really important for railroads to develop. And as the engines were really the driving force and the energy, the locomotives, the railroad tracks were really the infrastructure. And it's this that I think is essential here, is to develop that infrastructure in so far as one can on an international basis so that everyone runs on the same tracks and that things are in harmony in terms of standard application. As we know, standard set of principles in technology is so important to go global, but equally here, there needs to be something in parallel on the legal side, a new infrastructure to be developed. And I think that's where to enable those to develop where the Equitas principles come in. And we've already gone a little more granular than the very basics of the essence of procedural fairness and natural justice and due process to point out what are the types of things that are required, that there's a fair hearing, an independent tribunal, and those very basic tenets, but within the online world.
Thank you. Because it's true, isn't it, that actually when you move to the online world, you don't anymore take for granted some of those fundamental freedoms that you think you have in the so-called real or material world. And Professor Semple-Leben, you mentioned that earlier, that you were surprised at the extent to which society had just sort of walked away from those freedoms, embracing the technocratic ecosphere, if you like. But maybe you, Professor Semple-Leben, you could talk a little bit to what you call soft law initiatives at the international level and how organizations like the World Intellectual Property Organization might be instrumental in bringing about a concrete manifestation of what Equitas is trying to do.
Yeah, actually, I'm very happy to speak about these earlier initiatives. In fact, there was the insight that it may become difficult to shape further law and policy making simply on the basis of international treaties, as has been done traditionally in international law. So we have seen initiatives at the World Intellectual Property Organization, but also at other international organizations that can be qualified as soft law initiatives, where the member states agree on certain texts without giving them the status of formally adopted international treaty, formally adopted during a diplomatic conference. And instead, these documents as soft law instruments would rather have the status of an international recommendation that, because of its broad support by a large number of member states, gives indications for a harmonized way of developing the law. So we have seen a joint recommendation, as these instruments are called, a joint recommendation on the protection of well-known trademarks, for instance, a joint recommendation concerning the use of trademarks and other distinctive signs on the internet, which concerns also the question in which country actually an infringement can be assumed to have happened, even though online content in principle is available worldwide. So there have been successes in this area. And I would say what we have created with the Equitas principles is something that could serve as a starting point for such an initiative and such a conversation. I'm not expecting that the Equitas principles as they currently are would directly serve as a compromise text for such an international initiative, but at least the underlying ideas, the principles as such, offers important impulses for such an initiative. For instance, the idea that there should be sufficient information about what is going on, that at some point, at least at appeals level, there should be an option of human review. Users should have the chance of complaining about what's going on. These are very fundamental considerations of checks and balances that I think could be applied universally and could have chances of making its way into an international soft law instrument.
Professors Trimble and Rosati, does that resonate with you in terms of the research and the work that you both do, that there are underlying principles which don't necessarily exist as such in the online world, but there's increasing recognition that they have to exist and that there are developments through the case law and through joint recommendations that indicate that we are moving towards asking the necessary questions, which Equitas is also a contribution to that discussion. Would you say that was a trend that is growing in power?
I would think so. And I would just add that we might think of the potential of the Equitas principles and their effects, not only in terms of the soft law generation at the international level, but also in terms of their potential influence on national legislatures and even on courts. So even in the United States, we have seen a number of instances of different attempts to somehow change the current legislative framework for the liability of intermediaries, both in terms of the Communications Decency Act under Section 230 and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 512. And once such initiative is really taken on by Congress, I would not be surprised to see if a document such as the Equitas Principle could be useful in influencing the legislators' thinking about how these new legislative frameworks could look like. We have seen, for instance, that the GDPR had quite a bit of an influence in the United States, in California, and in a number of other US states. It's not inconceivable that it will will affect future federal legislation on personal data protection. And in the same way, I could imagine that the Equitas principles could have some effect on what's going on in the United States. I mean, recently, even Supreme Court Justice Thomas recognized that we have in the United States a problem with the regulation of internet platforms and the way they are treated, particularly in circumstances when some of these platforms hold what could be understood as monopoly, a position on the market.
Yes, I would just like to echo the remarks that have just been provided and limit myself to noting that indeed we are seeing courts struggling to extract, identify, and shape these principles vis-a-vis legislative frameworks that are not always clear or they really are lack sufficient flesh for courts to work with. And so this task of bringing these principles from the offline to the online world is something that has really made life hard for courts around the world. And hopefully having a common ground, something that can be applied irrespective of the jurisdiction attended, as the Equitas principles also try to be, is something that might be useful to policy and lawmakers, as it was just explained, but also to courts around the world when they have to apply legislative frameworks, which from the point of view of the digital dimension might still be lacking in substance and therefore content.
Thank you very much. It's a lot to cover, and I really appreciate each of you giving concise responses to sometimes quite general questions and having to do so in a short space of time. But I think that what we are really looking at now is, I like the term compromise text, the description of the Equitas principles as a compromise text, but to give it its credit, its due, it's probably going to be much more than that. And what I'm hearing from you is that we are talking about developing a tool with which we can really realistically try to influence governments and state actors as they struggle with balancing the contradictions that we've talked about, overblocking versus underblocking, securing freedoms and protecting people from harm. And I noted that the BBC covered in an article on the 23rd of June, they were talking about an organization called Campaign to Legal to Say, Legal to Type. Have any of you heard of that? It's a new campaign supported by various British MPs and Index on Censorship against some of the excesses of the UK Online Safety Bill, which Professor Mostert mentioned earlier. It seems to me that there is a growing movement, there's growing recognition across the world that these various powers that online platforms and providers have and the lack of procedures online is adding up to something of a legal crisis, which I believe the Equitas principles will help to resolve. And I would like to thank all of you for the work that you're doing and ask you as a group whether you would be interested in coming back to follow up with where your project is at and any individual projects that you're working on. Maybe we could do a catch-up or a follow-up conversation when suitable. How does that sound?
Yeah, we would be delighted to. Only a pleasure, Anna.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. I'm going to put all of the links to what we've referred to, whether it's draft legislation, reports, the Equitas links, all of that, everything that's referred to, we'll put them up as resources for people.
Anna, thank you very much.
This podcast is brought to you by the Dixon Poon School of Law at King's College London. Subscribe to The Verdict wherever you listen to your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at KCL_law and follow the Dixon Poon School of Law on LinkedIn.